Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Today's first guest is a familiar voice if you listen to NPR's Weekend Edition. Host Scott Simon wrote In Praise of Adoption in a 2010 book entitled Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other. His latest book is about a different kind of adoption. In Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I Have Known, Scott Simon reflects on how pets unlock our hearts. Scott Simon, welcome.
Thank you. Very good to be with you, Nancy.
You know, your book, for those of us who love animals, has so many things in it that we know are true about animals that we love. So there are much of your book that we had experience with, but we also learned about you. For example, your dad was a comedian?
Yeah. I mean, some fathers are police officers. Some put out fires. some are factory workers. Some are accountants. My father was a comedian. Yes, absolutely.
Well, your book is illustrated.
Although he would say that my mother was the real comedian.
Because
an interviewer asked her once, what's it like to be married to the funniest man in Chicago? And my mother said, I wouldn't know.
Oh, yeah, I get it. Okay, so your book is illustrated.
Yes, and, by Leanna Fink, the great New Yorker.
Yes, I was going to give you a chance to give a shout out to her. And I want you to tell listeners what the cover of your book looks like.
Well, Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I Have Known, at the very top is Ulysses S. Cat, who was the last cat in my mother's life, last pet in my mother's life and my late stepfather's life. And I should explain, there is some rich irony in the fact that he gets the honor of the title, because he did not care for our family, me and my wife and our children, so much, because we would come to visit my mother. And, she would, particularly our daughters were younger, she would go, hello, babies, can I get you anything? Yes, what would you like to eat? And Ulysses was convinced that this was the voice that was saved only for him. So he was rivalrous and jealous. But at the same time, he gave unstinting comfort and joy to my late stepfather, who was then mostly bedridden. And it was a difficult time for my stepfather, when he felt that he was just kind of hanging on and hanging around and not contributing much. And it was Ulysses who said, I like you. This is great. I need a place to plop. Put your arm around me. That's all I want out of life. So he's on the cover.
Well, now, since you're mentioning Ulysses, the fact that you put the S there tells us which, because there are more than one Ulysses he could have been named for, but the fact that you have Ulysses S. Cat. Oh.
Because he's named for Ulysses S. Grant.
Yes, as opposed to other.
Mm-hmm. My late stepfather owned the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop in Chicago, and so it was Ulysses S. Grant, of course. Yuli, as we call him. And right below that, there is a wonderful drawing on the cover of our French poodle Daisy, who writes haiku, as you may know. I mentioned that in the book.
Yes.
And she seems to be writing a haiku, or at least, may I read one of Daisy's haiku?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay. This is the deliberative process that she goes through when we're walking Daisy on a long morning walk. She summarizes it in this haiku. Not here. Sniff. Not there. Some other dog once went there. Here. Right here. Yes. Ah. Isn't that beautiful?
Yes, for a cat, for a dog.
Yeah,
yes.
You write about what you know. What can I tell you?
And, well, I like the expression on her face as she's writing this. Of course, your artist has a sheet of paper there in front of the dog. I don't think you've given her name yet.
Daisy Richard Simone. She's French. We have the French pronunciation.
Oh, mais oui. And why would you give a dog a French name?
Well, she's a French poodle.
Daisy, yes.
Well, and our daughters got to name her, and they named her after a dog in a very famous children's book. And I did not know until we saw the movie, Ugh, which has Owen Wilson and Julia Roberts and a dog named Daisy. And it became obvious to me in like the last 20 minutes of the movie that this movie, Daisy, would not make it to the end of the book. You know what I mean?
Oh, yes.
And I turned to our daughters and said, But all right.
In fact, I sometimes when authors write about dogs, and I just don't want to, I said, can we not talk about the dog if something happens to the dog? Because I don't think either of us could make it through the interview if we have to talk about that sort of thing.
That's true. I try to be oblique about it in this book. But
you know, yes, yes.
And it's all part of having a pet. It's all part of loving them, too.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah, that's why so much of your book, those of who love animals, just know, oh, my gosh, that's so true, what he's writing there. Well, there is one other character in your book that has four legs, and I like the little sketch that your artist did of Bagel.
Oh, Bagel. We sometimes give it the French pronunciation, Bagel.
Oh, oui.
Daughter's, our oldest daughter's hamster, because she's the hardest working person I know. I wake up more or less at 5 every morning to write. And I knock on her door at 5:30 because she opens up a deli at 6 a.m. And then when she is done working at the deli, she goes on to work at a barn because she loves horses. And she had an internship at one point where she worked with wounded horses. And so she works with horses now and teaches riding and works with horses in a direct and personal way. In any event, Bagel, her hamster, I had no idea, because I didn't have a hamster as a child, I had no idea how splendid Bagel auditoriums have become, which is where they stay. As a matter of fact, I hope I don't get ahead of myself, Nancy. We offer ours on rental for weddings, if someone is interested in that. We can make Bagel's rodentarium available.
Well, you know, I mentioned the three animals on your cover and Ulysses S. Cat, but I kept thinking, but he's not the cat you write about the most. And I kept thinking the title of your book, I thought, oh, poor Gato. But his name is not the one on the cover. So who is Gato Blanco?
Our foster cat. We had some neighbors and friends in the building whose apartment got flooded out. And they moved into a hotel in the same complex, and they couldn't keep their cat there. And they said, would you? And particularly our youngest daughter had been tirelessly campaigning for a cat. And we would respond to her. Let's put it this way. I learned from interviewing so many politicians over the years. I would say to her, yes, we should have that conversation. Should we get a cat? Yes, let's have that. That's a good conversation to have. So ultimately, of course, we had the cat in our arms, and he is the Orson Welles of cats. He is enormous and didactic and expressive. And, he is... About a dozen times, this is my estimate, he has crawled up from where I'm talking to you now, which is the broadcast desk that's in my home office, where I have the microphone and the laptop. But I also have lots of pictures of our daughters and mass cards from my late mother and other pictures, postcards, that sort of thing. And Gato will just jump up and will swish his tail and sometimes hit the microphone and often knock over a mascot or a picture in one case, a brass shoehorn that I got in India because our daughters think the fact that I love shoehorns is hilarious. And there'll be a sound and I have to interrupt the interview and explain what happened. And this has happened while I've interviewed very famous authors, entertainers, actors, scholars, intellectuals, people on all sorts of subjects all over the world, none of them, and I mean not one of them, has said, you know, can't you keep your cat off that table?
Oh, speaking of British accent, you promised to raise a cat just British.
I did, because Leona was in the possession of three interns at the British Embassy, escaped through a bathroom window, and the embassy official decided that we should make a home for Leona, but said, you must rear her as a British cat. So we agreed to do that, put pictures of David Beckham over her food bowl.
Well, I want to conclude with this sentence in your book that touched my heart because I happened to have read this sentence when I was sitting in a neighbor's living room. We weren't saying a word. We were each reading. And this is what you wrote in your book. The animals who join us in our lives remind us that often the best thing we can do for one another in life is just to be there. So thank you.
I wrote that and I believe that.
Oh, I do too, Scott. I do too. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Nancy. Very good to talk to you.
After a short break, I'll be back with my next guest, Jim Hassey, who has written short stories. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Author Jim Hassey was a Green Beret in Vietnam, an undercover narcotics detective, and a federal postal inspector. He has taught meditation and worked as a drug and alcohol rehabilitation counselor. As he faced PTSD and his war experiences, he began writing short stories. His first book, Warriors and Friends, is a collection of 38 real-life war stories. He has now put together stories of people, places, and predicaments that go beyond story of war. The title of this collection of short stories is Lovely Kentucky. Jim Hassey, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to be here with you, Nancy.
Well, I'd like to first ask you about your story about an undercover narcotics agent. And this agent is named Ted. The story is told in the first person, but I think you do through your stories. You give different names, even if the story
yes.
is true. But we wonder, is this Ted? Is this really Jim?
Yes, it was my alter ego. It was really me all the way through.
So it starts out rather, violent, if that's the word I want to use. How did you start that book? It was shocking, because that's the first sentence. What a shock. And so how do you start this story?
I started it off with the most explosive action I could imagine, which was about as true as I could make it. Working undercover narcotics at a Mississippi River Festival near St. Louis, buying drugs. And basically, my partner and I had zeroed in on a couple guys who were willing to sell us $5,000 worth of heroin.
Gosh.
And I went back to the car. And when I got there, suddenly I was in a bear hug. And I had an alcohol-breathing monster over my left shoulder. And coming at me was the biggest, ugliest biker I've ever seen. He looked like a madman. His teeth were pulled apart, and he was just red in the face. And he said, "You freaking narc." He said, "You're dead." And I couldn't believe it. Here's a knife coming right down at me. And I struggled and fought and used every bit of training I'd had in the Army, and managed to get my arm up just as the knife came down and it lodged in my left arm, actually sticking in the bone. And he was working to get it out. And I had a Mauser 380 automatic pistol that I carried in the back of my jeans with a rubber band around the handle to keep it from sliding down. It wouldn't have been appropriate with jeans and t-shirt to to be carrying a holster or anything. So I was trying to get that out. And as I was trying to get it out, I get stabbed in the stomach. And he's trying to twist the knife, and I'm wrestling pretty hard and heavy now. We're on the ground, and I manage to get the Mauser out. And just as I do, the guy behind me wrenches it out of my hand, puts it up to my back of my skull, and I hear click, knowing that he pulled the trigger with the safety on, but then he manages to pull the safety off. And when he fired, I pulled my head forward, and it exploded, and I saw stars. And luckily, it was not fatal. It was a very serious scalp wound, and that was enough to propel me to throw the other guy off of me and get the pistol back. And I was on my knees at that time, and they both started to run from the area, and I fired three shots at them and then collapsed. So that was the exciting moments.
This is my guest, Jim Hassey, and he's reading from part of his book, and the title of this section is Nothing to Fear, but it sounds like a lot to me. He was an undercover narcotics agent, a detective, and you're working with a partner. And
yes,
I'm sure you gave a different name to in the book, your partner Mike Higgins, and you and he had been assigned to an undercover narcotics unit. So you'd been working together, you say, for almost a year, and he had made several major arrests. But here you are, it's a hot summer night, and you were at a Mississippi River Festival, a rock concert near St. Louis. So what was this? What happened next?
Let me read a couple pages. I think it'll bring it into clear focus.
Yeah.
My partner, Mike Higgins, and I had been assigned to an undercover narcotics unit working together for almost a year. He and I had made several major arrests. On that hot summer night, we were at the Mississippi River Festival, a rock concert near St. Louis. We had parked earlier in the evening in a public parking lot behind a clump of trees near the edge of a woods. There was a natural trail that ran through the woods 50 yards from where we parked. It was after 10 when we were in the process of making a $5,000 heroin buy. I had gone to our car in the north parking lot to get the money. I had placed my radio on the top of the car and was unlocking the door when I was attacked. As I was laying on the ground, close to losing consciousness, I heard my portable radio crackle with Mike's voice yelling, "Gavin, Gavin, where are you? Gavin, where are you?" I struggled to my feet, reaching for the radio, and in my confusion, turned it off and on a couple of times before I keyed the mic. I was suddenly confused, not knowing what to say, but blurted out, "Mike, I'm hurt. Officer down. Mike, I'm by the car, by the car." The music from the concert blared in the background. I heard Mike yelling, "I'm coming, I'm coming." I dropped the radio. As I slid down the side of the Camaro, I strained to think, is this real? I couldn't feel any pain. I touched the back of my head and felt a bloody, mushy spot with a chunk of scalp missing. I examined my stomach, and it was tender to the touch. Every part of my body was shaking. Dizzy and confused, I kept asking myself, is this real? Mike rounded the corner and slid into a kneeling position to my left. He was panting and excited. "Oh my God, have you been shot? Let me see. Where is it?" He pawed at my bloody t-shirt. My chest heaved up and down as I told him about my attackers. There were two white males, one short and stocky, one big guy. They had beards, mid-30s. Both wore denim jackets, dark tees, and jeans, dirty blonde hair. Guy in the front had a gap between his teeth. "Are you shot?" Just grazed in the back of the head, I said. I think I'm okay. I was stabbed here. I placed my hand over my belly. I think that's the worst of it. I looked at my bloody palm. I'm disoriented, bleeding pretty heavily. I was getting even more dizzy and confused. I tried to sort things out mentally, but my brain was scrambled. Mike called for help. "Madison County, this is Meg 20. Officer down. officer down. Make 10 needs an ambulance for a serious stab wound. We're at MRF in the north lot. I'll put a red flasher on the top of our unmarked car. So that kind of sets up what's going on there. I had lost all track of time, and Mike kept trying to get more information, knowing that it could be critical if I didn't make it, that they have the best description possible. But it seemed like a very short time, and I heard helicopter blades. And it was reminiscent of Vietnam. I've been wounded in Vietnam and been medevaced on helicopters. And lo and behold, a helicopter came in, and they said they were taking me to Belleville Memorial Hospital.
Yeah, and so Mike kept trying to get you to stay awake. And he's referring to you as Ted in this story. But we know this is actually what happened to you.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So they put you on the stretcher and carried you off to the helicopter. And you wave to Mike, this character, as you are lifted off. So you were asked to give information, and you weren't really very capable at this point.
Well, with the helicopter noise and the pain and discomfort I was in, suddenly the pain erupted, and the back of the head was one thing, but the guts were really uncomfortable, and I started asking for meds. Can I get some meds? And of course, they were saying head injury, no meds. Head injury, no meds. We landed, and there was a team out there from the emergency room, and as we walked in, there was a doctor I came to understand was Dr. Brand, and he everything was normal with people hurrying around, some excitement, but there was this nurse. And I think the story is going to diverge a little bit from true reality to maybe imagination.
Well,
but
let's see.
There was this beautiful nurse, blonde-haired nurse, and she was walking beside me, and she had a calmness about her that was just overwhelming. And she just said, "There's nothing to fear." And I said, "I got a lot to fear." And she said, "There's nothing to fear." And she walked with me into the emergency room. And when we got in there, I heard the sounds of, as blood pressure's dropping, pulse rate's up, we've got to stabilize him. And I remember asking the doctor, I said, I'm fairly newly married, and my wife's a narcotics officer too. Hopefully she's coming. I don't want to go to surgery until she gets here. And he looked at me, and he leaned over, and his head's looking down at me, and he says, "Do you want to die?" And I said, "No, I'm going to pass on that tonight." He said, "Well, we're going to surgery now." And meanwhile, this beautiful nurse steps closer, and I look at her name tag, and her name is Gavin, the same as the name I was using.
And that's an unusual name.
An unusual name. I had never met anybody that, at least as the story goes, I had never met anybody other than family members with that name. And I commented, I said, "You're Gavin? Really?" And she says, "Yeah, there's just a few of us around, and we need to stick together." She says, "Most important thing to remember is there's nothing to fear." And that was the touchstone from what proceeded from there.
Well, when we're reading this, we just, it is a very emotional read for me, for example, to read what you went through, because I'm assuming up to a certain point, this is all really what happened to you. Now, when does the fiction diverge from the reality?
Well, I slipped in the nurse, Gavin. It was true. My real name is Hassie, and there was a nurse named Hassie there. So, and changing the story from Jim Hassie to Ted Gavin, I'm just bringing out the fact that this nurse had a very unusual name, Hassie. I've really never met any other Hassies other than family, and it surprised me that she had that name tag on, and it gave me a feeling of comfort knowing that there was maybe some divine intervention here, that there was someone with my name who was telling me not, that there was nothing to fear. But of course, from this point in the story on, the fiction kicks in, as you will understand by the ending.
Well, Jim, I think there are people who would beg to differ. Because you might label the end of your story paranormal, but I have heard and read so many similar stories to what you're recounting that I think they would say, nah, Jim, maybe it's normal, and we just don't understand it, but maybe it is normal. So I even wondered, and I won't ask you to say, but I even wondered if this part of the story was part of what you experienced.
Well, I had some strange dreams, and I had a feeling of comfort that came over me. I can remember kind of coming out of anesthetic and being rather sick, and somebody said again in the background, and I don't know who, I placed the voice, at least in my story, on the nurse, the lovely nurse. Again, someone said, there's nothing to fear. And I thought, that's really strange. In the operating room, as I'm kind of coming to some consciousness, and a voice is saying, nothing to fear again. So that was very fascinating. And of course, in the operating room and in my story, all the things that are happening, as you could imagine, would happen when someone is, you know, dying. And that they're clearing, and my heart has stopped beating, my blood pressure's dropping, everything's going down, everything's going south, and here they are taking the paddles and putting them on my chest and yelling clear and shocking me and trying to get that going. This is going on for quite a while, and then
and your character, I'm saying your character, not you, but maybe you. The character Ted says, I was looking down on everyone from above. That's when he was placing the defibrillation paddles from this car.
Yes.
And saying clear, as you said. And obviously, if you're talking to us now, we know that the reality was you survived this episode. But I'm going to ask you to read the last three paragraphs in this story, Nothing to Fear.
Yeah. Let me slip in one more, the one right before that, where you just said the words, but let me say it once more. I was looking down on everyone from above. Dr. Brand lifted a set of defibrillation paddles from a cart and placed one on each side of my chest. Clear, he announced loudly. My body arched upwards and bounced on the table. The sound of the flatline and the other alarms kept shouting ominous warnings. My nurse watched calmly from across the room, with her palms together in front of her as if in prayer. Why were all these people so excited? I wondered. It's not the end of anything. Actually, it feels like the beginning to me. After another violent shock and a few more minutes of action and intensity, a technician walked over and turned the alarms off. The medical staff stood quietly together, sadness and resignation in their faces. Dr. Brand shook his head in defeat. As I continued watching from above, I wanted to tell them, there's nothing to fear. They're staring at my lifeless body and then slowly walking out of the room. All was still and quiet. The medical staff was gone, but I didn't feel alone. My nurse was with me. And in that moment, I realized she had been with me my whole life. Only fear kept me from knowing.
This is my guest, Jim Hassey. He is reading stories of people, places, and predicaments. This story that he was just reading, the beginning of it, happened to him when he was serving as an undercover narcotics detective. And in the story, the medical personnel walks out of the room, and so we assume that this character, Ted, died. And, of course, you didn't. But there are a lot of stories similar to what you have recounted, Jim. Haven't you heard stories like this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the things I was thinking about. And the stories are absolutely amazing and believable in that people report what someone said in the hallway. People report what doctors say. And the anesthesiologist and other experts say, no, there was no way in the state of their consciousness at that time they could have heard anything or seen anything. We have so many reports like that that there's something to it, and that's what I wanted to bring into the story.
Yeah. Well, people have had these experiences, I think, will appreciate that fact, Jim, what you just said. After break, my guest Jim Hassey and I will continue our conversation about his collection of short stories. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Jim Hassey, who has written a collection of short stories of people, places, and predicaments. Now, the title of your book, Lovely Kentucky, now, the listeners can't hear, there's a comma after lovely, and that's quite important. Because
it sure is.
Because the first time I just glanced, oh, lovely Kentucky. Kentucky's lovely? No, that's not what the title is telling us. And this was during a time when you were a federal postal inspector. And you might tell listeners what the cover of your book shows.
That shows the lovely Kentucky Post Office. And it is probably about 250 to 300 square feet. And it's painted red, white, and blue, and it had a beautiful flag flying from it the last time I saw it down there. And this was like so many post offices throughout Kentucky and other parts of the country where their whole identity is in that post office. They may not have a general store, they may not even have a gas station, but they've got a post office, and that's their community identity. And this started because of a postal burglary, a break-in at the lovely Kentucky Post Office.
Yeah, this little post office is tiny, and it looked like a strong wind would blow it over. And I wondered if you took that picture, did you?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Because I looked to see who had got the credit for photographing that post office, and I figured it must have been you. So there's the title of your book, Lovely Kentucky, and this is when you were a federal postal inspector. Now, we talked about the fact that the story we just talked about was happened to you, and both of these stories, Fear Nothing to Fear and Lovely Kentucky, are both told in the first person, but I think this is even more, can I call it more true, Jim?
Oh, yes, yeah. It's interesting. A lot of people don't understand postal inspector. They think that you're inspecting post offices and things, which that's a branch of the inspection service. But there are 105 federal laws relating to postal employees on duty, postal property, and the U.S. mails. And some of those that are most recognized are mail fraud. You know, a lot of the old Michael Milken, Leslie Helms, Reverend Joe Baker, and all those were postal inspector cases. They were fraud cases. I was sent to a one-person office in Ashland, Kentucky as my first assignment when I graduated from basic training, postal inspector basic, in 1978. And they wanted somebody there who had a lot of experience in criminal investigations. Although I was a new man, it was a small office, And it was called the post office burglary capital of the country.
Oh, my goodness.
Because I think they were averaging somewhere around 20 burglaries a year. And the interesting thing was these little offices, like the one on the cover of the book, there, 300 square feet or so, they would have in most of the time the postmaster would actually take the stamp stock and the cash home. And maybe leaving the money order machine. Sometimes they even carried that home. But the local boys down there who needed some extra money to buy some hooch on Saturday night would think of the post office as a money center because their relatives may use that in lieu of a bank. They go to the post office, get their money orders. Money order's good anywhere. Everybody will take a money order. So if they can steal the money order and the money order machine and the validation plate, they've got some opportunity for great reward.
Well, you know, your first story, serving as an undercover narcotics detective, I could see how that could be dangerous. But now, a federal postal inspector, I wouldn't think that would be dangerous, but I learned otherwise when I read your story. So would you read a little bit of who the bad guy is?
Sure. My pursuit of Chester Barnett had started 6 months earlier with the burglary of the U.S. Post Office in Lovely, Kentucky. A sturdy, locked metal cabinet had held $60 in cash, $500 in stamp stock, 141 blank money orders, and the money order machine. The cabinet had been prized open. Within 2 days, more than 15 money orders had been cashed at various locations in Pike County, Kentucky, and across the state line in Mingo County, West Virginia. From the U.S. Postal Inspector's office in Ashland, Kentucky, I began to run down leads on three different men who were passing stolen money orders in amounts from $20 to $300. The name Barnett came up early in the investigation. In these parts, Barnett was as notorious as Hatfield and McCoy. As a matter of fact, the area was called Hatfield and McCoy country. The McCoys reigned in Pike County, Kentucky, the Hatfields in Mingo County, West Virginia. The two families had been involved in a century-long feud resulting in several murdered members of both families. The feud became synonymous with the perils of family honor, justice, and revenge. The Barnett family was known for moonshining, illegal liquor sales, burglaries, and dealing in stolen property. On the one hand, Pike County was the kind of place you think of when you hear the word Appalachia. It is a dry county where illegal alcohol was easily found, lots of churches, coal mines, pickup trucks. People were pretty simple in a good way. Bib overalls, neckerchiefs, and baseball caps were the uniform of the day. On the other hand, Mingo County in West Virginia was the kind of place you think of when the movie titled Deliverance comes up. With bars all around, it was not at all a dry county. Alcohol was sold legally in grocery stores, gas stations, and everywhere in between. 20 miles northwest of Williamson on Interstate 52 is a backward hillbilly community called Kermit. The close to 300 people living there were related either by blood or marriage and frequently by both.
This is my guest, Jim Hassey, reading from his collection of short stories, Lovely Kentucky, and that happens to be the name of this story that he's reading now, Lovely Kentucky. And this is all what you experienced. Now, you could probably use the real names of the counties in the parts of West Virginia and Kentucky, right?
Yes, yes. And actually, I went ahead and threw the True Barnett's names in there, too. That was the family, and they had all, I don't have to worry about breaking any confidentiality. They were all, you know, arrested and tried in criminal court and sentenced to prison. So I used their true names, the Barnetts.
The night that, so you arrest Chester Barnett, and you stop by the sheriff's office and spoke to the sergeant, and he was pleased to hear that you had a federal arrest warrant for Chester. So
yes.
How did you, tell us more about this story.
Well, I hooked up with a postal inspector in West Virginia, who was covering that territory, the western part of West Virginia. I was covering the eastern part of Kentucky. And so Mingo County was his and Pike County was mine. And a lot of the stolen money orders were cash in West Virginia, so he had jurisdiction there. And Jim was not well schooled in sneaking around, let's say. And I remember one of the funniest stories. We were out looking for a safe that supposedly had been peeled open from one of the other post offices. And we were looking through some heavy brush, and lo and behold, I heard a gunshot and screaming. And I got over there, and he said, "I've killed a water moccasin." And it was about an 18-inch long garter snake. And the poor thing was shot in half. And I realized then he didn't have a lot of experience in the woods. And that's what it was going to take to get Chester.
You know, that made me laugh also, because when I was growing up, I used to go by this lake. And watching a water moccasin swim through water is one of the creepiest things. made me run the other way as fast as I could. So that made me laugh too, Jim.
Yeah. So anyway, we had been to the Barnetts three times before I finally got Chester. And would you like me to summarize that a little bit?
Yeah.
Well, we identified Chester right away, and I managed to find his cousin, Junior, and Junior Barnett was scared to death of him. He said Chester killed people. He said there was no doubt about it. Chester murdered people. He knew it, and he said he's Chester would kill me, and Chester had given him some money orders to cash. He had cashed them for many hundreds of dollars, and Chester had given him $20 only, told him to keep his mouth shut. Well, I managed to work a deal with Junior that I would see that he went to federal prison instead of state prison if he would cooperate. And he said he wouldn't sign anything, but he would give me the information I needed to catch Chester. So from there, we started our trek down to Chester's home in Kermit and met Ma Barnett. And she was a piece of work, one of the most interesting characters I've ever met.
She sounded like it. Reading about her, oh, my goodness, I wouldn't want to meet her.
She was a character, and she always cradled a shotgun in her arms every time I saw her, except the time they took it away from her when we were doing the search warrant. But the first time we went down, simply, we liked to talk to Chester. And she was with the shotgun across her chest saying, "No, get out of here. None of my business, none of your business, go away." So the next time we came back, we got a subpoena to take handwriting from Chester. Went back, nope, no way, you're not coming in, can't look around, can't go to the barn, forget it. So off we went, and then the third time we came, we brought two deputy sheriffs from Mingo County with us, and they were there just to back up and make sure everything went well. And that's the funny part of the story. And would you like for me to explain what happened during the search?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're wearing coats and ties and looking kind of handsome. And when you look at this house and the innards of the house, it was just a pitiful sight to see. There was dirt and dust everywhere. The bathtub had dirty clothes and trash in it. The dresser drawers were strewn around the room. There was, in the sink, there were dishes piled up. There was grease in a skillet on the stove. And she was in her little white flower dress blue flower dress. And she was a force to be reckoned with. And she had two sons besides Chester. She had her other two sons living with her were Lester and Buster. And, they accompanied her and tried to support her as best they could, but they knew to keep their mouth shut. The day we went to do the search warrant, I presented the papers. She didn't like it. The deputy sheriffs took away the shotgun, put it in the trunk of their car. And Jim Nimrock and I are going to decide where to search and how to find. Well, it didn't take long to search the house. It was it's pretty easy. But then I see a trap door, and the information we had was that there was a money order machine being held, that's where the money order machine was taken, one of the burglaries. So we tried to figure out what to do. No ladders. I pull a kitchen chair over and manage to delicately, I pulled off my tie and sports coat now, and I'm climbing up through this trap door in the ceiling. And I'm, and in the roof above, it is as dirty as you could imagine. And I ask her, I said, Mama, what's up there? And she's nothing but dead cat. I said, dead cat? She says, yeah. I said, well, how did you didn't take it down? She says, no, we don't have no ladder. Okay, no ladder, chair. I'm on the chair and I managed to squeeze up through the hole. And this was kind of like parallel bars where you put your arms on each side of the 2x4s going into the roof, into the ceiling, and lift yourself up. And I remember getting up there and saying to Nimrock, hand me a flashlight, which he did. And of course, as in situations like this, the batteries were dead. So that's my first problem. Then the Nimrock presents the second. He says, how are you getting down? He says, that chair won't hold you again. I says, don't worry, we'll work it out. Let's do this search up here. So off I go, and if you could imagine a ceiling with the beams, the wood beams, and the 2x4s going across, and I'm crawling slowly, and sweat is running in my eyes, and I can hear them talking below, and I'm now above the kitchen and farther down, and there's these nails coming through the roof, where you have to keep your head down or else it pokes you in the top of the skull. And I'm doing this great stretch out there and I see a brown, it looks like a trash bag or something, there's something in it. And I reach for it and I've got it. And just the second I had a hold of it, my elbows slip off the 2x4s and my body shifts off the beam I was on and I went right through the ceiling. Feet first, then torso, then arms, and right on the kitchen table. I'll never forget getting off that kitchen table and the looks, the faces on the people around me. Nobody said a word. Nobody said, how are you? Are you okay? And I was glad they didn't. And I thought, oh, please, dear Lord, don't let me limp away from this house. Let me just walk out of here with a little bit of pride. And with what we had discovered was in the sink was it looked like a furry pan in that it was a dead black cat that was squashed flat.
Really, because when I was reading it, I wondered, is there really a cat up there or is she just saying that?
There was really a cat up there and it was on a bag. I don't know why it was up there or why they never got it down. I can't imagine what the smell would have been like as it deteriorated. But there was the cat in the sink and Mama Barnett had her Campbell's soup can and she was chewing tobacco and spitting into it, just shaking her head, looking at me. So we concluded our search and gave them the proper paperwork from the search warrant execution, and it was time to go. So we left at that time, but of course, and I realized that we had one more time there. Let me explain that. I think this is significant, is when Nimrock and I decided we needed to sneak up on them at night and try to get him at night. And that was the funniest one by all accounts, because we went and got some camouflage fatigues for him. I had jeans and a dark t-shirt, but he wanted to camouflage fatigues and put on face paint and everything. It looked like something out of a B-level war movie.
I thought that was pretty funny, Jim.
It was really, I kept sitting there looking at him before we went out to the house. And we made it out there at night and made it up to the edge of the woods. And our plan was to wait there by the edge of the woods, right where the trail is, hoping that Chester would come out of the house and go down the trail or come up the trail to the house and we'd grab him. And we waited and we waited and we waited. And Nimrock, not being too patient, it seemed like about every 5 minutes he would cough or clear his throat or something. And I would go, shh, stop it. Shh. And he would say, oh, sorry. And so this went on for the longest time. And finally, he said, I've got a rock.
This was funny. I thought this was also funny. And I wish we had time for you to tell this story, but I think people will want to get a copy of your book and read what Nimrock, and was that his real name?
Yeah, close.
Okay. What he did with that rock.
Yeah. Okay. That would be a good one to leave it there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jim. My guest has been Jim Hasse, and his latest collection of short stories, Lovely Kentucky, Stories of People, Places, and Predicaments. Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Winter Surrender. Old age holds us hostage. It uses aches and pains, societal expectations, and health impacts to shrink our comfort zone to make us live smaller. We adjust our understanding of life to fit our diminished world. It comes slowly, sitting at the edge of the bed in the morning. It waits for us to notice the stiffness in our hands. It lets the knees speak first, then the hips, then the back. It doesn't demand surrender. It suggests it. It recruits society as an accomplice. Take it easy. Age gracefully. At your age. It's not because we are incapable. Rather, it's because we are persuaded. It teaches us to edit joy, to resize it, trim it down. We tell ourselves smaller pleasures are enough. The long ride becomes a short walk. The hard climb becomes a memory. The days of testing yourself against fear become a photograph on the wall. Life doesn't shrink on its own. We negotiate it away. We change the rules. Trails become risks. Ladders become hazards. Night driving becomes unnecessary. Conversations shift. We are praised for wisdom instead of strength. Congratulated for survival instead of ambition. The inherent risk is that the question of surrender becomes hidden behind platitudes pretending to be wisdom. It becomes the easier option, so we dress it up as sage advice. Every age in negotiation needs to ask the same question. Am I redefining joy, making it smaller? If the answer is yes, that's not wisdom. It's the S word. Brad Johnson.
Forgetting. Forgetting. Thank God you're here. At last, take this burden, both embraced and renounced. You relieve this foolish heart of its object, its longing to join those who have escaped as though through fire. But I do grieve to see you now. Please tell him it was not fleeting, and the forgetting is not free. Hilary Lindauer Vasey.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.